Bren Jensen of Edmonton Global and your conference host for today's event. I hope you all have your coffee, your glass of water, your mug, whatever you have. We have an exciting program for you today. Three keynote speakers and five panel sessions. Each of these will be followed by a Q&A as well as breakout rooms for you, the audience, to collaborate on ideas and network with other panelists and breakout room moderators. The entrepreneur behind this event is Ms. Eva Borsanto. She's the founder and CEO of FutureSight Incorporated. Eva, say hello.
Good morning, everyone. Get ready for the exciting lineup we have for you today. This event, Gen XYZ Thrives, was made possible by our amazing team, partners, and volunteers. On behalf of FutureSight Inc. and our partners in kind, the Edmonton Chamber of Commerce, McEwen University, NAIT, and the Canada-Alberta Partnership Grant, we would like to thank all of the organizations who are participating, who are here with us today. So let's have a show of hands for them. Thank you, and back to you, Brent.
Perfect. Thank you, Eva. We'll get right to it. Our opening keynote speaker is Mr. Stephen Harrington. He's the Director of Human Capital for Deloitte. Stephen, welcome to Gen XYZ Thrives. Now, Stephen is Deloitte's National Lead of Workforce and Strategy. He's been a writer and speaker on the future of work and workplace of the future since 2011. 18 years of experience in consulting, Stephen leads transformations in talent strategy. He's also the co-author of Intelligence Revolution, a recent paper on the fourth industrial revolution and implications for Canada in participating with HR Professionals Association of Ontario. It's a mouthful. Stephen is going to share his insights on the future of work. Now, there's no doubt that COVID-19 has transformed the way we work, the way we interact, the way we buy, as well as AI. Now, he's going to be available for our panel session, Q&A, and during our breakout room sessions. So post your questions into the Q&A section on your Zoom screen, and we're going to try to answer as many questions as possible as well. Feel free, again, to use the reaction emojis whenever you'd like. I'd ask you that you keep your mics muted until the breakout sessions. Stephen, off to you.
Thanks, Brent. So I'm going to keep this very short, but I want to give you a quick overview to kick off the day of the way we think about how the future of work, the so-called future of work, is going to impact you as employers, you as job seekers, you as educators. You know, one of the things I've been speaking and writing about the future of work since 2011, which is a long time to be on a future-focused topic. And I will say that what we've discovered over that time is the secret is not to make bold predictions, but to look for the things that are driving the fourth industrial revolution. We've been through lots of industrial revolutions, so we know the pattern, and we can look at those trends and really help employers and educators and job seekers figure out what it means for them. Those drivers will manifest. The only question is how quickly. And, you know, Brent mentioned COVID. COVID has been in the news in my space a lot over the last few months, the general theory being that COVID has accelerated us to the future of work. I mean, look at us right now. Here we are holding a convention. We didn't get on a plane. There are no pastries and coffees necessarily, right? There's some ups and downs. I wish I could see you all and tell some jokes and hear you laugh. But here we are. And it's already having an incredible impact on our ability to employ anybody anywhere and to distribute work in ways we knew was possible from a technology perspective, but maybe we weren't doing as quickly as the technology would allow. So let's talk about work. And the reason I want to talk about work is that too much of the focus about the future of work and where we're headed as an economy is on technology. Technology is incredibly important, but technology is important insofar as it changes work. Sometimes it doesn't. Look at the self-checkout at the grocery store. That's my favorite example of what I call zombie technology. It's zombie innovation. it didn't quite get to the point of changing how customers experience grocery shopping, and it certainly didn't change the work itself. So it's actually become a largely unproductive innovation. If we really want to get quickly to the future of work, we need to figure out how to get people and robots working together in concert for new opportunities for new levels of innovation and new levels of productivity. What we heard about the future of work early on was that it was going to be a robot apocalypse. Everybody worried that the innovations, the technologies were going to take jobs away. Some of the early predictions in 2014, 2015 said that up to 60% of jobs would be fundamentally disrupted by 2020. Here we are in 2020, and I would argue 60% of jobs are still relatively okay. So what's really going on, and this is important for us to understand whether we're seeking work or whether we're an employer, is that jobs are not being disrupted, tasks are. And the real opportunity for us, and this is hopeful for everyone, is can we target the tasks that are dull, that are dangerous, and that are expensive, get them out of work, and be left with jobs that are more meaningful, closer to our customers, closer to citizens. What I'm talking about is what we call the unleashed workforce. It's machine and human working together. If I think about, for an example, the growth in drone use in industrial Canada and in energy and resource spaces, when we were watching that trend early on, the thought was, we need people who are going to be expert in drones. We need people who are going to be expert in video capture and building machines that can spot things on videos. All those things were true. But as it turns out, what you still need is people who know how to inspect industrial sites, that know what to look for, that can take advantage of the, you know, outside of the human spectrum kinds of things that we can capture with these robots and interpret them and quickly manage them into valuable insights for their employer. So I hope that makes sense, because it's key to what I want to get through today. Everything you've learned in your job so far, every experience your employee has, is just as critical. What we need now to do is to leverage technology to amplify that know-how, not to replace it. The other thing that's critical to understand is that, well, this is a bit of an obvious point, but hey, technology is moving much faster and accelerating much faster than anyone can keep up with. That includes policy, that includes businesses. But let's think for a minute about why. Why is policy slow to catch up with technology? Well, one of the key reasons is, and this is interesting to governments and educators, is we don't do a very good job of allowing policymakers to try things out and fail. We expect them to make policy that works 100% the first time. And that's a little unfair when everyone else is experimenting. So that's one of my challenges I'd like us to think about. How can we allow policymakers to experiment, try something, pilot it, maybe fail, and try again so they can keep up with technology? For businesses, what's happening is they're deeply invested in capital, in resources, in technology, in people. And our whole economic system tells businesses, we go through this too, to wring as much value out of those investments for as long as possible. Which means, even though we might want to keep up with technology, it's very hard to do. So for businesses, the question is, how do we more quickly turn over less expensive investments in things like technology so that we can keep up? But maybe the most important point here is look at where individuals sit in this simple graphic. They are the most likely to be able to keep up with technological change. But for most employers and educators, we tend to take what individuals learn about technology and lock it away. They can do it at home, but they can't do it on the campus, and they can't do it on the employment site. So there's a little challenge for all of us and for us as employees to try and bring what we know about technology to work every day. Why are we even talking about work is something that often comes up. I mean, we've been through big technological changes before. But what I want to point out here is that the time that it took to go from the typewriter and the personal computer and along with it, the fax machine, to the cell phone was actually decades. I'm sure some of us still have fax machines in our offices today. It's taken a long time. And when those technology changes take time, it leaves us as businesses and as humans time to catch up. But what's been happening in the last two decades is that that pace has accelerated to the point where that sort of organic change to new technologies is no longer fast enough. And I'm belaboring the point, but what I think that means is we have to start a conversation not just about the technologies, but about how the work itself needs to change. We need to design that change. We need to push that change, particularly as educators and as employers, to go faster and make it easier for employees to learn at the pace they need to. Learning is an important point, so I just want to take a minute here to talk about skills and how they're changing in the future. You can see the top skills by 2030 are becoming more cognitive, and that things like physical and manual skills and basic cognitive skills are becoming less important. But I want to be really clear here, that is just an overall reduction. It is not an elimination. And one of the overreactions I often see in the market, and in parents sometimes as well, is we want to push everybody away from the physical and the manual and the basic cognitive skills. And that is counter to what the market needs. It's counter to what it will need by 2030. We still have a truck driver shortage. We still have trade shortages. We have to make sure that there's a balance in the way we think about this. And one of the ways to strike that balance is to recognize that there are actually two distinct types of skills that everyone builds through their careers. On the one side, there are the technical skills. We know what one of the challenges with technical skills, and if you're a job seeker, this might make you feel a little uncomfortable, but I have to talk about it anyway. Technical skills are starting to fall off faster. If you built a technical skill in the 1960s, you could be pretty certain that technical skill would survive through your whole career. Today, the half-life of the skill, a technical skill, is somewhere between 2.5 and 5 years. That means we all need to turn over our skills much more often. And employers need to turn over the skills of their workforce much more often. So that means we need to think about whole new ways of approaching learning. But on the other side, on the left-hand side here, you can see we're talking about capabilities. And sometimes we call them the future-proof capabilities or enduring capabilities. Imagine a worker who's learned how a particular trade, carpentry trade, works on a job site, for an example. I've covered industrial Canada for over a decade in a previous research life, and I will tell you that on the job site, there are carpenters who are new, and there are carpenters who have been there for long enough that if you want to know how that whole job site is operating, you might go ask them, because they know not only how to apply their trade, they know how their trade connects to everything surrounding their trade. In other words, they know the architecture of their work. And that architecture knowledge is an enduring capability. It's why we seek out people with that much experience. The other type of enduring capability to think about are the innate ones. We're looking for people with high conceptual thinking, empathy. The only warning for employers is, let's be fair, innate capabilities are very hard to change over time. And we don't want to tell Canadians they just have to be faster, smarter, and better looking in the future. But we do want to recognize that, you know, if you're a job seeker, think about those psychological factors that you're really strong in. And then think about trying to apply those to the types of jobs where you will be most successful. I'm going to make a really quick point about the skills problem, just to tell you how deep the challenge is. It's a $2.9 trillion problem by 2030 for the world. So why do we need to change? Look, even though we've invested so much in fourth industrial revolution technologies, productivity is actually declining. I'm just reinforcing the same point over and over again. I'm sorry, I'm obsessive. Why is this happening? It's because the technologies themselves are not enough to build productivity. We have to better integrate these technologies into the ways people actually work. Really quickly, here are some realities that we need to think about that are with us right now. The first is the human is augmented. That was that drone story I was telling you. If I can get an expert with a drone, I can actually inspect more equipment with far more effectiveness, way more often than if I spend all my time trying to teach that drone how to inspect all by itself. And that pattern is going to remain true through this entire industrial revolution. 2060 is a whole other conversation we don't have time to have right now. The other is you need to learn differently. And this is very true for employers and for educators. We need faster, cheaper, smaller learning interventions that are directly connected to going directly into work in order to afford that $2.9 trillion problem I described. If we keep trying to learn the same way, we'll never get there. And the last one I'll mention here, because I'm going to run out of time, is open talent is unavoidable. And the really interesting point there is, if you're a job seeker and you haven't looked into the contingent workforce, the so-called gig economy, look again. That whole employment market is growing at 2 times the pace of the whole rest of the Canadian employment market. I'm not talking just about Uber. I'm talking about sites like Upworks or Amazon Turk. There are tons of them. If you do a quick Google search, where you could quickly go from applying to working through a completely digital labor market attachment. Okay, so how do we get there? Advice for employers and educators is to get really disciplined about how you build future skills. Don't just get a top 10 list. Look at what your strategy is, and then think about exactly what skills do I need to execute that strategy that I don't have today. And make sure you know exactly who's going to learn them to make it manageable. Bring data to understand what tasks could be disrupted within the jobs that you hold. Because remember, it's not the job that's going to get disrupted, it's the tasks. And that's a whole new way of thinking that it's very hard for us as employers to do unless we apply ourselves to. And then finally, come up with strategies for new ways of working. Before COVID, that would have been about agile, lean, all kinds of interesting stuff. Right now, I'll say to you, just about every day of the week for me, it's about remote work. How are we going to make remote work ways of working work is a big, big topic here. And then if I'm talking to employees and candidates, think about how you invest your skills, balancing those technical skills I was talking about with those longer lasting enduring capabilities. And please remember that almost anything you want to learn is just a Google search away. I can't believe how many people don't take advantage of the free online learning available today. And the second point is redefine your idea of what security means as something that's in the future. We've tended to think that security is that job that I can have for 30 years. But the truth is, real security is in keeping up with that technology curve that I talked to you about. And then finally, find opportunity in new ways of working. Remember, you can be employed anywhere at any time using the types of technologies that we have available today. So that's it. I'm just a touch over time, Eva. I apologize. I practiced 15 minutes, but I probably got geeky there somewhere along the way. But I hope that was a helpful kickoff for the territory and the way we think about the future of work here at Deloitte.
I don't think you were over time at all, Stephen. Really, we could do this whole session just on you alone, I believe. Thank you so much. That was just the tip of the iceberg, I feel, of the type of knowledge that you have. We're going to go to Q&A. Right now is the audience's opportunity to type into the chat box any questions that you have for Stephen. I think what stuck out for me, Stephen, in that the most is that statement that you made that it's not the job that's disrupted, it's the task. As well, I'm really, really interested into around remote work, especially through COVID. I might ask you how you might, if you could add some clarity or some color to, you know, I've brushed with many organizations. One of them has told me that through COVID, they've moved 60,000 employees all to remote work without laying off an employee. And they've actually found out that their productivity has increased. And I run across smaller organizations that are worried about remote work and want their employees back into the office so they can manage their employees. So I feel like there's also a gap between management and workers, or understanding what productivity is or how to monitor that. I know that's not really a question in there, but would you be able to add some color as to why that might be, and how we might overcome that in SMEs in the future?
Yeah, well, I mean, so it's an incredibly complex topic because it involves humans and they're so unpredictable. But we did move millions and millions of people globally overnight into remote work arrangements, which is frankly incredible. Lucky us that we were far enough along in this portion of the Industrial Revolution that the cheap technologies, and they are very low cost, were there and ready to catch us. But, you know, I do think that the productivity picture is very mixed. We did a study in the US of about 12,000 workers. And when we asked them if they could work effectively from home, 80% of them said they could do the majority of their duties as effectively or more effectively from home. But then, because we had some clever researchers involved, we asked them some more detailed questions about the kinds of work practices and behaviors that we know lend to remote work productivity. And only 50% of the 80% were able to actually demonstrate productive behaviors. So not surprisingly, I think there's actually a big gap here. We did this very quickly. What we need to do now is figure out how to make remote work permanent where it makes sense. Mm-hmm. The most popular solution in the market, by the way, is hybrid. It's this idea that I am going to reopen my workplace because I need a place to ground my culture. I need a place where I can run a war room or have a library or a cafe. That kind of work needs to keep happening. But I also want to give my workers some flexibility because I think there is a productivity and engagement advantage. There are all kinds of challenges with that too. We probably don't have time to get into, but you know, one of them is we did some further research and we found out that most people who would have an option to go in whenever they wanted would want to go in on Wednesday, right? Not very many people wanted to go in on Friday and not very many people wanted to go in on Monday. So imagine you're a large employer and now you're trying to plan your workspace and everybody arrives on Wednesday. That's going to be very inefficient. So just to give you one example of the tough decisions and issues we need to work through.
We have a question in the chat from Corey. Now, it says, what about the capabilities of individuals? How does future work look for those that might not have the abilities or capacity for the new technology wave?
Yeah, well, the new technology wave, it's partly on the new technology wave. There's a great little video that Adobe put out. If you Google Adobe bank robbery, you'll be able to find it. It's meant to be humorous. Guys come in and they're robbing the bank, but the punchline is that the bank's video technology recognizes who they are, translate it to the back end system, so the teller can see who they are, but also some of the things they might need from a bank. And she just starts asking them questions like, "Hey, John, I think you might be looking for a mortgage. Did you know?" And it solves their financial problems and they give up the robbery, right? But the point is, first of all, that is technology plus human making a different experience. But it also doesn't require that individual to have any advanced technology knowledge in order to operate that technology. It's been designed so that it's easy to use, as it should be. I actually don't think 2030 and 2040 technology is going to be about us all knowing how to code. I think it's going to be about us knowing how to work with information coming at us from technologies and knowing how to apply that to expertise we probably already have.
Yeah, I like that. This question around AI, how AI shouldn't be noticeable, but it should increase our productivity. Speaking of productivity, Monica also asks, how are you measuring productivity? Now, that's obviously different for each trade and changes through COVID and remote work, but what are some measures of productivity that we could use to both from a management perspective as well as a worker perspective?
I work with our chief economist enough. I'm not going to give that answer. That one's too macro. It ties back to something else you mentioned, Brent, which is, well, let's look at about this in the remote work context, but it works in any context. The question becomes, as an employer, how do you do a better job of understanding what outcomes you expect from each employee and then measure those outcomes as opposed to measuring attendance. That's a big mindset shift for us as employers in North America. I've been really cruel in the past, and I've said that workplaces and field operations have often operated more like prisons than workplaces, meaning that we have a spot for each employee so that we can make sure they're there. And that's been a proxy for productivity and one that's been terribly ineffective. But if instead I could say, hey, Brent, 2 weeks from now, I think you and I can accomplish X, and then I spend all my time working with you to make sure that X happens, now I'm actually driving productivity, assuming that I know how to identify outcomes that are important to my business. Hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We do have time for one more question. This one actually comes from Eva. She says, suggestions to the construction trades, especially the sub trades in the next 3 years. Of course, this given that Tim Coldwell will be speaking next on our agenda. But
yeah, well, we talked about this, didn't we, Eva? I've done some work with the trades associations over the last few years. And one of the things I'll often say to them is, hey guys, why don't you go on the offensive? Because look, that task disruption I was talking to you about is going to impact different roles at different paces. And one of the biggest employers in Canada are the people who employ people in the financial services industry. And I'd go right after them. And like, I can imagine a dark and brooding ad that says, thinking about becoming an accountant, think again. Right? But trades in particular that are not tied to worksite, it's going to be very difficult to automate their work. They will be working alongside machines, as I described earlier, but there's still a shortage in trades, and the likelihood of mass disruption in trades is low. So I continue to tell people who are wondering, what should my kids get into in the future? Look, I work for Deloitte. I'm not saying don't become an accountant. There still will be accounting jobs, but trades are way underinvested in for the future in the health of our economy.
I think that's a fantastic insight and something to leave off. Stephen, I think one last quick question for me is, do you do coaching? Because I think I want to be first in line to figure out what I should do in the future. Thank you so much, Stephen. Everybody ought to give you a reaction for that, for sure. Next on our agenda, we do have to move on. So how is COVID changed? How has it changed the trajectory of work? So joining us for panel session number one is our panel moderator, chamber and panelists, Mr. Sam Piller, CEO of Jobber, Dr. Eddie Wong, he's the Associate Dean of the University of Alberta, Asipa Samji, Senior Vice President and Acting Chief Human Resources Officer at Stantec. Now, Alan McDonald is the Senior Vice President, National Client Development for Global Public Affairs. That's a mouthful. And after Bill